Part two of a four-part conversation with Anne Diamond for The Liminalist, the podcast between. Anne and I are discussing Leonard Cohen. So you had an on-again, off-again kind of love affair with him over several years, is that right?
Yeah, I would say not several years, just maybe, you know, a year, by 1979 it was really over, so really less than 2 years. You know, it was positive, it was exciting, and something was going on, but he certainly wasn't my only, you know, I had other men in my life, I had other boyfriends and people I saw, you know, but he'd come into town and I don't know, telepathically, I knew when he came into town, and we'd get together and things would happen and, you know,
mm-hmm.
And that seemed really positive, and it went on for, you know, until I went to Greece in 79, and then I saw, you know, he said, well, go to Hydra, I'll meet you on Hydra, and I'll be there in July or something, or June, and so I made sure I was there in June, and he didn't show up till August. By that point, you know, it was, I knew things, I had seen things, I had heard things that I didn't like at all,
mm-hmm.
were quite disturbing, you know, stories about him and so on. And there was a worship of him on Hydra. People worshipped him as a god. I'd never seen that. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it. I was from Montreal, and Montreal people were quite negative about him, you know. They didn't, I didn't know anybody that liked him, really, or thought he was a good person or really even a good musician, you know, in 77. He was kind of considered to be washed up, has been, and someone was a little bit, you know, mixed into pretty dark stuff, you know, not nice to women. He didn't have a good reputation in Montreal at all. So I went to Hydra, but then I kind of decided he's worth, you know, he's actually an interesting and lovely man. He was very nice, kind, you know, generous, you know, kind, basically. And so when I get to Hydra, I find people are ready to, you know, they'll kiss the ground. I mean, they told stories of him that he was a god, you know. They would talk about him all night in the bars or the. I just listened. I couldn't believe it. You know? But it's a different. It was a different crowd there, and they had a whole different take on him.
Hmm.
I think because in Europe he was something else. That, you know, in Europe he, I think he actually had a very genuine run in Europe, starting in about 1970 earlier. And he just dazzled people there.
Hmm.
And I've seen the tapes, and I can see why.
And
you know, I've seen tapes.
And did you experience him differently as a person when you interacted with him on Hydra?
Absolutely, from the time he showed up. You know, I didn't know what to expect, really. I mean, I spent 2 months there with people that he knew, so, you know, talking to me about him and telling me their history with him and all sorts of things, you know, all sorts. And the story of the Geekus Mansion, you know, someone told me all about that, and I didn't like it. Some of the stories I didn't like one bit. They often involved the occult.
Since you mentioned the Geekus Mansion, and before we get to the occult, tell that story because people won't know what it is.
Nikos Geekus was a very well-known Greek painter from a wealthy family, and he had a mansion on Hydra, and it was a kind of a dating back, I think, to the 30s. I mean, he, you know, I don't know how old he was in 1960 when Leonard came, but anyway, Geekus was a very famous Greek artist, and his house was full of paintings, his own paintings mainly, and it's on a hillside outside the town of Hydra, kind of off by itself, and I guess, what did they describe it as? I can't remember how that writer described. Anyway, it was quite a massive, palatial kind of place. And he was living with the ex-wife of Victor Rothschild when Leonard arrived in 1960 or 59, and Leonard went to visit him. I mean, other artists and famous writers, especially Henry Miller, had visited him earlier in the early 50s or late 40s or whatever. And, you know, he wrote Miller wrote a book called The Colossus of Marusi, and he describes his wonderful meeting with Gica Sanhedra. And so 1959, Leonard shows up. He's a young up-and-coming writer, and he knows Jacob Rothschild, and who's the son of Victor Rothschild, and they've essentially told him about Hydra and Gicas.
Mm-hmm.
So he shows up at the door, and the story I heard was he shows up at the door, knocks, asks to be let in to visit because another artist paying a visit, and they said, "Go away, you can't come in." And so the story I heard on Hydra was, as he left, as he walked away into the night or whatever, he turned, shook his fist and said, and shouted, or cursed this house. And then the story goes, the next day it burned to the ground in this fire that destroyed everything, gutted the place, destroyed all the paintings. And Gicas, you know, left and never came back.
Huh.
And it was told to me by a kind of a friend of Leonard's, told me the story, but the look in his eye was, you know, when I remember this guy called Albert, right? Albert told me the story about Leonard, and he's looking at me, and his expression said, it was, you know, told me he was wondering if I believed it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that? And I believe it or disbelieve it. I said, it's possible, you know, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
What other explanation, you know, is there? I mean, but...
How do you mean, what other explanation?
Well, at the time it didn't occur to me that somebody could have set the fire. Somebody, you know, that it was... That the story was a cover. That he told the story because he had to say something. Because someone knew he'd been there. I mean, I don't know. He wanted... Why, you know... As I said, I remember the conversation I had with Albert and hearing that story, and, you know, eyebrow goes up, you know, and he's like, so what do you think? And I have no opinion, you know. I know nothing. I mean, back then, 1977. But now, you know, I didn't know at the time that Rothschild in London, I think Albert told me about Rothschild, said, yeah, the Rothschilds, you know, are... supported Leonard, and you know, I think he did. He talked about them, but he was from a wealthy Dutch family, and they probably knew the Rothschilds themselves. I mean, he'd grown up next door to the Queen of Holland, son of a banker. This is Albert, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he knew Leonard, so he knew some inside stuff that I didn't know. But
and when did he claim that the Rothschilds had supported Leonard Cohen from? Like, what time period?
Early on in his career. And he also told me another story. He said, around that time, Leonard had just gone to London, you know, he said he met the Rothschilds, you know. Oh, wow. You know, he met the Rothschilds. And then he went to this famous psychic, and he told me the name of the psychic. He was some European, you know, psychic to the royal families or something. You know, some famous guy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who. And reading Leonard's chart or whatever he did, he said, kings and queens will hear your voice. And, you know, again, this was one of the... I mean, Albert was trying to seduce me, and he invited me to his house for dinner, and then the way that you seduced people on Hydra was you talked about Leonard Cohen. You know, that's how you seduced women. That's what they did, these men. They bragged about their connection to Leonard Cohen.
Right.
And, you know, it worked a lot of the time. In this case, it didn't really work, but that time...
Did he not know that you'd already had an affair with Leonard Cohen?
Well, I don't think people really believed, you know, that I had an affair with Leonard Cohen. I didn't really match the... I wasn't in the league with the Suzannes, you know, and the beauties that arrived. I mean, you know, the international beauties would come looking for him. I was like a hippie, you know, from...
So you were kind
Canada.
Of anomalous then in his life.
Yes. Yeah, I was a total anomaly. And that's why I also it all seemed so miraculous to me, you know.
Hmm.
I mean, I was cute, you know, but I wasn't, I had no clothes, you know, or anything. I didn't have style. I didn't have sophistication. I didn't have, you know, confidence, nothing. And the women that, you know, he was associated with were really quite something. You know,
Do you
and they had a
think
veneer, you know.
that Leonard Cohen was conflicted about your presence in his life then, and that during that time?
I think he adopted me like, oh, you know, a bit of like a stray waif, but with a very, not just any stray, but someone that he planned on. He would say, you know, we're going to be together for a long time, things like that. You know, he would say those things. I mean, you know, and you know, this is made in heaven. Various things he said made me feel special, but I had no idea why. And I assumed, I was really kind of naive, but it's because I was writing poetry, and he read the initial, oh yeah, the excuse for phoning me up, you know, was that he'd read one of my poems in an anthology that had just come out that someone had given him, and he said, and yours was the only one I liked. This is what he said to me. So, you know, what do you, I thought, well, maybe he just thinks I'm talented or something, and I'm worth, there were some pretty down and out people that, you know, he befriended, some pretty depressing, dismal, you know, characters. And I at least had this little spark of, you know, something was going on. I didn't want to be his girlfriend. I really didn't. But I saw him as a mentor, you know, and he was, I liked him a lot. I was in love with him, but I didn't, you know, I was realistic enough to know I'm not his girlfriend. I'm not in that league, you know. But while it lasts, I'm going to enjoy it, you know. And yeah, I think he could see it pretty well right from the beginning. I didn't fit in with his friends, but I'm not ashamed really to say that I didn't, because you know there weren't people that necessarily I wanted to know either, you know.
So let's see if we can get a bit of the context then for you being there in Hydra and the whole environment that you entered into. So Leonard Cohen, I never know whether to call him Leonard or Cohen when I'm talking to you. I mean, I don't want to just call him Leonard like I know him, but Cohen must sound weird to you because you
No,
do know
no,
him.
no,
But
no.
anyway,
Let's call him Cohen.
let's call him Cohen. Okay, so Cohen had been there since the late 50s,
Yeah, where he'd met
and
Marianne, you know.
he was in Hampstead, where I lived for a period in the late 50s, and he'd gone over there from Montreal
Yeah.
at the same time as more or less several of his friends that are
Yes.
mentioned in that documentary. So
Yeah.
Mort Rosengarten,
Yeah, Nancy
Robert
Bacall.
Hirshhorn, Nancy Call,
Yeah.
and so there was kind of a gang of them,
Yeah.
and they were hanging out, going to parties and whatnot. And at one of these parties, they met Rothschild, Jacob Rothschild, and Rothschild allegedly said, "Hey Leonard, you'd really like Hydra. Why don't you go and live there?"
Well, it contradicts the
Oh,
other story. You know,
the other
it
story
was
that he
two
was
stories.
backed.
There's two stories. You sent me that today, and that's the first time, you know, I've only seen that today, so I haven't really thought about it. But the official story is that just by chance, on a cold day when he was working on his novel in London, he wandered into the Bank of Greece somewhere in downtown London and saw a poster on the wall and said to the bank teller, "Where's that?" And they said, "Oh, that's Hydra."
Right. It was the bank teller wearing sunglasses. I actually just
Ah.
listened to Cohen talking about this, telling the story, and I was thinking, he tells such a good story that
Yeah.
that's almost a red flag somehow. Like he seemed to be
Yes.
enjoying the telling of it, and of course I already had heard the alternate versions, so it made me suspicious anyway. But
Yeah.
it did make me think that the sort of power of the bard to cast spells and create narratives, and that so that's. This is interesting, just as a detail, because you're saying that's the official story. Well, yes, that's the story that Cohen always gave, but actually the thing I sent you today is in an official source, because it's in a biography of Cohen.
And they mentioned
it does say that it does contradict Cohen's own version by saying that he heard about Hydra from the Rothschilds. So then that would definitely corroborate your friend Albert's claim that that Leonard was being funded by Rothschild.
Well, you know, this is like how many years ago? 1977. It's it's nearly 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I remember that, you know, I remember everything that happened. It's, you know, in those days, it was strange. And, you know, anyway, I remember Albert talking about Rothschild. Now, Rothschild didn't mean a lot to me then, but I knew they're a very wealthy Jewish family. That's really all I knew, and they were very powerful, and I knew that. And I remember him using that. I just can see his lips framing the Rothschild. You know, I can just see it. And, you know, I didn't realize that Leonard knew the Rothschilds, but he was really, Albert at that point was emphasizing, I think maybe also trying to tell me how clueless I was, really, and how little I knew about Leonard,
right.
You know, how unworthy in a way, I mean, I was to even think I knew him, because I didn't know these, you know, I was not part of those circles. I think that was the undercurrent, is that, you know? So I do remember it. Right. But you see, right. if Rothschild, it's a very different thing. He randomly stumbled on it and was attracted to a poster on the wall and decided, I'll go to that island. It's a very different thing. It's a cover story. Real reason is Jacob Rothschild sent you there, possibly Victor Rothschild sent him there because his ex-wife was hanging out with a painter that maybe they didn't like. Excuse me. I mean,
you mean the,
it's a little kind of a close family thing, right? Gekas living with Barbara Hutchinson. Barbara Hutchinson was married to Victor Rothschild. She was the daughter of a peer. I mean, looked up Hutchinson, her father, and he was connected in with the Rothschilds and with MI5, and, you know, he was Hutchinson. We'll check him out sometime. But she was a daughter of, you know, peerage. And I don't know how she broke up, why she left Victor, but she ends up on a Greek island. You know, what are the possibilities there in that? And Leonard shows up at the door and they tell him, you're not coming in here. You know? I don't know. To me, there's, you know, things to question there.
Yeah,
and
the
house burns down, right?
Sure. And, I mean, there's a much larger backstory, which I've only just scratched the surface of, but regarding what was going on in Greece, not specifically Hydra, but the whole of Greece and the CIA's involvement in Greece during that period,
yes.
50s and the 60s and the 70s, and the backing of the fascist juntas, and they were essentially fighting communism there.
Yeah.
And part of the CIA's war on communism did involve cultural wars, right? So like I don't know if you've heard about I don't think there's a name for the operation per se, it was part of a larger one, I guess, maybe Mockingbird even, but about how the CIA helped to create the modern art movement.
Helped to create what? Modern
art movement.
I've read about it. Yeah, I've read that.
Right.
Yeah.
So you could see, tentatively anyway, you could trace an overlap here in terms of, I mean, Leonard's mysterious rise to prominence, which, as we've already discussed by email, seemed to begin with him being photographed on Hydra for Life magazine, which was...
In
1960, which was owned by Henry Lucci, so it was part of Operation Mockingbird, so he would seem to be being promoted at that time.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a general kind of... program to combat communism in Greece, the supporting these up-and-coming countercultural artists could be part of that operation.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jacob Rothschild, you must know he's a huge art collector, right?
Right.
He's mass, you know, his paintings. Yeah, he's a great buyer of art.
And then there's, of
Yeah.
course, Cohen's claims, and more than just claims, his history of being in the right place at the right time, of being in
Oh,
the
yeah.
middle of several revolutions during that period.
Always arriving 2 weeks early.
Right.
You know, the Bay of Pigs, 2 weeks early. Ethiopia, 2 weeks early. He was at, in the just there when the for the overthrow of Haile Selassie in 72, I think, or 74. Forget. Anyway, he goes to the what's that town in Ethiopia, Asmara. He just goes there for no reason, you know, from Israel. After
Right.
doing after touring Israel, he ends up in Ethiopia, soon to become Eritrea, because you know, and there's the coup is just getting going, you know, it's just starting the movement to overthrow the emperor was just getting going when he got there, but he stayed in a hotel in a CIA, and Asmara was where the US, you know, base was then, the CIA base was.
Right.
Well, just, you know, on vacation to write some songs. That's where he says he wrote the last version of the Janis Joplin. Anyway, we're getting off
Chelsea
topic here.
Hotel?
Chelsea
No, which,
Hotel.
yeah, that one.
Yeah, he wrote that in that hotel room in Asmara, or however you pronounce it. Yeah.
So, but presumably you were completely oblivious to any of these implications when you were actually in Hydra and trying to actually get close to Cohen. Is that right?
Yeah, well, no, yeah, I was oblivious pretty much. I mean, except that you know, I felt I had this adva the advantage of coming from his hometown, and of, you know, seeing this huge contrast in the way he was seen there. Well, anyway, a bit of an, I don't know, I wouldn't call it an advantage. No, it just put me in a state of shock and dissociation. Like I just watched it as a, I was watching it as a kind of a play that was going on, you know, and anticipation building up. And Leonard would phone the bar, Bill's bar. Oh, by the way, Hydro is a, was it really, in certain ways, an awful place full of very wealthy and phony people and hangers-on, and you know, and people with too much money, and they drank all the time, and they had some artists that they kind of they
So
patronized,
this
and
is
you know,
expatriates generally, not rather than Greek people.
yeah, that's the scene. Greeks were really not very welcome in Bill's bar. I mean, they had a Greek bartender, and otherwise Greeks didn't go there. And it was very snob, a very snobby scene. And this was Leonard's hangout, you know. And I walked in there, and I mean, it was not my kind. It was not my scene, and that was obvious. And they made it clear that it was not my scene, and I didn't drink, you know. You were supposed to have a bar bill there. You're supposed to just, you know. It was ridiculous. Anyway, they waited with bated breath for Leonard to arrive. And 1 month it went by, and another month went by, and he still hadn't come. And they would phone regularly from the bar. They'd phone him in his studio in LA, and he'd say, "I'm still in the recording studio. I It's taking longer than I thought." And you know, and
What year was
finally,
this?
at 79, and he was producing. He was recording recent songs, that album. If you've ever seen that one with the blue cover, you know, the portrait of him.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah,
Yeah.
I think he said it was his favorite, which I found quite surprising.
I don't know. Anyway, he brought it. He brought the tapes with him when he finally arrived. He brought the tapes with him to Hydra, and then people kind of lined up for a chance to. He would play them into select circles of people, you know. And I was, I didn't. When he arrived, you know, I met him in the port. I mean, he was friendly, and he looked so awful and old. You know, there was a 17-year difference between us. And but he didn't look just old, he looked rotten and corrupt to me. I just wanted to get away from him, and I felt very guilty about it, you know. That was, you're asking how did I, you know, how did I was trying to get close to him. I bumped into him a few days after he'd arrived, maybe 2 days after he'd arrived. He was still jet lagged. He looked terrible with his hair greased back, just like Ronald Reagan, you know. And I just said, "Oh God," you know, just. But it was just something. I'm not really. I seem to me I pick up on people's inner, you know, condition rather than just how they look on the surface. I can forgive somebody. I don't care about people's appearance that much, but I can forgive them looking tired and, you know, wrecked. But something was wrong, you know. Something was ugly, and I just wanted to run away, but I. Stood there for a few minutes and talked with him, and then he said, "Well, you know, I'll see you at the beach sometime, you know." So, you know, I ended up, yeah, seeing him at the beach. So it was odd. By that point, he'd accumulated an Australian nanny. His kids were that they had been there. He was surrounded by the groupies and the crowd, you know, that had been waiting for him. And I was. I preferred to stay on the outside, you know, of the whole thing. But I got invited to dinner. I mean, I showed up at the beach, and I got and said, "Come on over for dinner." So I went. I got into the house, you could say, you know. A lot of people couldn't get in, right?
Right. So, when you mentioned Reagan there, it occurred to me that because you've written about, I think it's pretty relevant here to go into how Leonard seemed to develop this affinity for Reagan and for Reagan politics, and so I mean I think that's interesting to look at and talk about a bit, and just generally as well, like what was your sense of Cohen's political views during the time that you knew him?
Well, all right. I always sensed, I always knew he was on the right. I didn't know how far right, and I didn't. I also felt that his sympathies were with, he had a kind of sympathy for people like me, and for the, there was a leftist component in his personality. And he said to me once, you know, my mother had a very right-wing foreign policy and a very left-wing domestic policy. I think he meant that to, in that he had adopted that himself. What it meant was strangers were subjected to very harsh criticism and, you know, right-wing kind of views. But when it came to close family or friends, big-hearted, you know, mm-hmm. she was big-hearted or she was generous and kind. And that's how, and I think something with him, it was the same. His politics were quite conservative, but I didn't really, you know, after I told you that first night, I started to, it started to be about politics almost, you know, and we disagreed on we would have disagreed on anything if we'd gone on talking about it, but why would you, you know, you're in somebody's kitchen, you know, why do you want to talk about that stuff? But it, you know, I didn't understand just how far right he could be until John Lennon was shot. And that's when he told me, he showed me a copy of Newsweek, and with the headline or somewhere in the magazine, it said, Lenin's out, Reagan's in, or Reagan's in, Lenin's out, was on somewhere in the Newsweek of the following week. This was in 1980, December, when I was again on Hydra. I was spending the winter trying to write a novel. I had a Canada Council grant, and I decided I would spend it there on Hydra, and it would be a good place to spend the winter. What a stupid mistake, but anyway, and Leonard just showed up one day in a cafe. He had a copy of Newsweek. I didn't know he read Newsweek. He had a beard. He, you know, he, well, anyway. And he said, yeah, you know, you got to read this. This is really good. And I said, well, you know, Ronald Reagan, he said, he's a great guy. I love the guy, or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's like, why? Why would you even know? I mean, why would you even care? I mean, I think he was, at that point, Reagan was president, right? He'd just been elected in November, and this is December. Yeah. So it was like, how can you, he's going to be a great president. It's going to be great for Israel. I was just kind of like, well, how would you even know? He's only been president for 3 weeks, and why do you have these, why are you so enthusiastic about the guy? He hasn't done anything. Mm-hmm. You know, where did this enthusiasm about a politician I thought was just a clown, you know? I mean, nobody liked him. Nobody took him seriously. And he was just, he said, well, he was, and I could see the look, you know, he was taken aback that I had, that I didn't believe him or something. He said, well, but here, read this. And he showed me this part of this article in Newsweek about Reagan and how he'd composed a cowboy song when he was 12 years old or something, just like Leonard, played the guitar. And Leonard said, this is what I really love about him. You know, but he's, you know, just a way to kind of diffuse the, you know, I love him because he's a cowboy and I love cowboy songs. But just, so I guess we didn't go too far, you know, so the conversation wouldn't go any further. But anyway, I was in shock over it. I just thought, what a stupid thing to like Ronald Reagan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know anybody who liked Ronald Reagan.
And but did he talk at other times about his political views, or did you get a sense of what his worldview was
Earlier,
during the time that you knew him?
Well, just more that, you know, no, he was pretty secretive, frankly, until the fall of 1980, because I didn't only see him on Hydra. I mean, if you're ever, anyway, I had this Canada Council grant, and I was doing a little Greek island. I went to one Greek island. I went to the island of Samos. I went to Egypt. And then I knew that Leonard was doing a concert in Tel Aviv in the end of November. So I kind of started to hitchhike I took a taxi across the Sinai Desert. Actually, that's how you did it in those days. I found a guy from, this young guy looked like, Roger Daltrey. He was British, who was sang in a band, and we took a taxi together, and we went to Jerusalem together, and then the next day I went to Tel Aviv and met Leonard at the airport, and mm-hmm. with a band as they were arriving from somewhere in Germany or something, and this was the last concert. So this was in November of 1980, and we were still on pretty good terms, but he kind of welcomed me onto the bus, and then I knew some of the musicians because I had done this before. I did it in 79 in England, and I'd been welcomed on the tour and taken around several cities with a Cohen, you know, entourage that time. So I was trying my second try was meeting him at the end in Tel Aviv, and it was legitimate, you know. I mean, I'd go to the concert that night, and so hung out with the band again. And during that time in Tel Aviv, he got into talking about the Irgun and Menachem Begin, who was his friend and a guy he really admired, and the Stern Gang, the bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, and that whole, he was I don't know if he was, there were other people around, but he was telling me definitely, and that this was, they were, he admired it. Mm-hmm. He, you know, where this bombing, I didn't know the historical facts at the time. I was in Israel for the first time. We were in Tel Aviv, you know, at the hotel there. He starts talking about these, you know, heroes of the Israeli independence mm-hmm. struggle. And, you know, I was going, you know, wait a minute. But, you know, didn't have the internet then, so I couldn't go just look it up. And you know, a few weeks later, on Hidra, I met someone who's another intelligence person whose father had been the chief of police in Jerusalem during the time of the hotel of the King David bombing, and he filled me in on the whole history of what killers they were, what, you know, what a bloodthirsty gang they were, how many people they murdered. But mm-hmm. you know, in Tel Aviv around the time of the concert a few weeks earlier, Leonard had been singing the praises of these people. You know,
right.
Well, it made me nervous because I knew even then. I mean, I knew Menachem Begin was not our friend. You know, he's no friend of the Palestinians, and not a very nice man. So
in that documentary from 65, Cohen's talking about why he went to Cuba, and he's saying that he wanted to explore violence and that he was interested in killing, and then he made that comment about it's kill or be killed. And that, yeah. In this very sort of disarming, charming, self-effacing way that he had and has, I guess. So it just seems playful, and it seems metaphorical or more like a spiritual kind of thing, like he's talking about exploring his own internal darkness. Is of course how I would have interpreted it in the
sure.
past when I was a Leonard Cohen fan. But based on all the things that I've been discovering recently, I'm more inclined to take him at his word on that. So, I mean, how do you feel about that when he talks about wanting to explore violence and kill or be killed? How literal do you think he might be talking?
I read recently that Kill or Be Killed was the title of a short story that he published as a high school student in the high school yearbook. But I haven't actually ever seen it or found out if that's true. But I think that's in the Simmons biography. But anyway, but Kill or Be Killed is kind of one of his phrases, I guess, you know, one of his, you know, anyway, he's used it more than once. But like you, I would have taken that because I always gave him the benefit of the doubt. I thought he's being metaphoric, he's being poetic, he's a novelist, he's entitled to explore darkness, he's got to be able to put himself in the position of all these kinds of people. That's true creative genius, you know, and all that. But I think it's really ironic. I think he's always played on the literal meaning, being taken for, you know, he's played on the likelihood of people taking it as a metaphor when it's actually literally true. And I think mm-hmm. I think he experimented with that. Probably, I think that's something that happens to people who do very dark things early on in life. They learn that nobody will believe it. They learn early on that you can confess to things and people won't hear it. They won't laugh. They'll laugh. They'll think you're joking. And I think much of his work is literally true. Much of the stuff that shows up in his poems and his songs has always been literally true. And he just mm-hmm. uses the literal, and it ties in with the Zen, you know. Zen poetry is very literal. You know, if you very spare, very pared down, very kind of haiku, you know, it's kind of factual, you know. Right. But it's supposed to explode into a metaphor as you read it, and it's supposed to, you know, lift you up and enlighten you and show you different levels of reality, but I think the bottom line is he knows what he's talking about, you know? When he says these things, he was never... I don't find him to be an imaginative person, but people give him credit for being having a wild imagination. I somehow think it's more he's been involved in things from an early age, you know, where it's that are things that are so out there. There's so much on the edge of the conventional, right? I think that's what would happen if you grew up in a family, a crime family, for example.
Right.
You would witness things, you know, and you that are, you know, outside, they're so outside the normal.
Yeah, but they would be normal to you, and that would, of course, also make it disarming or disorienting if you were to talk about them in a matter-of-fact way. Nobody could believe that you were actually talking about what you were talking about, and they would have to presume that, particularly if you're a songwriter and a poet, that you're embellishing or that you're metaphorizing. And it was similar, not the same, because they're very different characters. But with Jimmy Savile in the UK, I mean, after everything came out about him, the truth, once he was dead, it was possible to look back over his career and his public appearances and the way that, and even his autobiography, he brazenly admitted to a lot of the stuff and even bragged about it and made jokes about it on public TV, primetime TV, and nobody believed it. I mean, nobody thought of it as anything besides playfulness.
Of course.
But in retrospect, he was simply... he was being transparent, ironically, and trying, yep, whatever you'd call that, perversely. And presumably part of that would... I mean, part of the... one of the effects of that would be a kind of auto-absolution, because if he's actually admitting to all this stuff, doing that kind now as much as Savile, and nobody cares, then that would be... a load off his mind, so to speak. Well, mm-hmm, you know, I've owned up to it. Nobody's judging me, so I'm in the clear, psychologically speaking.
Yeah, and it's a kind of a psychological... Well, think of, you know, the kinds of people that that were behind Savile. It also included the Rothschilds, MI5. You know, and experts in psychological manipulation, so they who would know about the trauma mechanism, and in a sense, you know, they know how people will, they would just reject, yeah, any notion that those things can be real. I suspect that the person who uses that, who learns how to play on that, they test it out a few times, you know, in the beginning when they test it out and see if any, and they find that people don't get it. And then I think that a great feeling of security must come over them, you know, that they're protected by a human mechanism of denial. But I also think that I wanted to say, you know, I think if you have powerful people protecting you, you feel protected to begin with, mm, you know. And if the powerful people protecting you happen to be involved in criminal activity, and they have gotten away with it, I mean, and you know that they're on your side, and I think that'll be. I mean, most of us would be too timid to try these things out, you know. But if you know that it's been done and it's worked, and you know,
yeah,
they have your back, I think you get quite brazen and outrageous, you know. And then that becomes part of your persona and their fascination, you know. Like people like Byron, I think, or Lord Byron, you know, was that type of character, and the people were just hooked on him, you know. They wanted every detail and every sequel in his life. They wanted all the details of his sordid, you know, activities. He was a legend, and I think Cohen also probably learned from that, you know, how you keep people hooked on you.
Right.
You tell them, you know, you reveal a little. Anyway. Or a lot, but, you know, you make sure to show no emotion also, which is another thing he, you know, most of us would get emotional talking about certain kinds of things, you know.
The house she lived in is now all we're left with. It'll take a lifetime to pay for this. All the nuns were singing. John said he ain't sure if she's dead or just hiding somewhere away from him. But we all still remember that cold December with your lawn ablaze and your razor blade drawn. I'm calling you back, I just want you to know.
Yeah, this is interesting in this regard, in general, what we're talking about in relation to Savile as well, that watching that documentary, that he, when he did poetry readings, he was received back in 65, in that earlier period, he was received as a stand-up comedian, and he would say these lines, and they weren't funny, and they didn't have humour in them, but particularly they were choice phrases, and they had a certain lilt to them, but it was particularly in the way that he read them. He had the audience eating out of his hand, and they were laughing at every line and kind of waiting for the next. And it was very interesting to watch, because I wonder if he discovered it by chance, that a certain way of being would create a certain reaction in the audience, and then he really didn't have to do anything. I mean, like I say, the lines he were reading didn't really have humour in them, but the audience itself was generating this kind of field in which he became really funny, and so that was disarming. That's totally disarming. And although he wasn't, the material didn't seem particularly dark in the clips I saw, it would be easy to see how he could move then into darker stuff and talk about, you know, joining revolutions or kill or be killed or Nazi doctors or whatever it is, and still have that same kind of mirth response, which is also relating maybe to what you're talking about with the trauma defense mechanism, humor being a big part of that. How we actually keep out the awareness is by having a sort of opposite reaction, which is we will laugh at it rather than feel the pain of it.
That's right. And, you know, comedy is often about horror. It is, you know, or you know, rage, anger, you know, it's all mixed in with the comic. I know, but another thing he did was he put things into rhymes. I think that made them sound like, you know, it sounded like nursery rhymes then, you know, and hit some of his dark, really dark things. There's that poem, Teachers, about going into a hospital.
Yeah, that's one that keeps coming to mind, actually. I meant to look at the lyrics, but I will before we talk again, I think, because that's the song that has impacted me quite a lot.
Oh, yeah, I agree. Me too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a lot of MKUltra imagery in that song, and I think it's really because it happened, you know. But anyway,
yeah. So I mean, we've probably have to wind up pretty soon, but we've touched on a lot, and we've been sort of skirting around what I think is one of the gorillas in the room. It seems like there's quite a lot of gorillas, really, when it comes to Leonard Cohen, but. The way that he came into your life and the reasons behind it and the timing and all the rest of it. Without speculating yet, maybe if we can talk again, we can start to speculate a bit more. As you said, you met him right after the Cameron revelations came out.
Yeah, within weeks of that. And he was just on the street. It's as if, you know, you can think, okay, reconstruct it. Well, having heard that, he came back to Montreal and he was wandering the streets and he looked bad. He looked, he looked discombobulated. You know, I remember thinking, you know, as if something really terrible had just happened to him. Well, I think his marriage was on the rocks and different things were going on, you know, the timing was really odd. And the other thing I found out, you know, because you can research everything, I found out, something had happened about a week before he phoned me that involved revelations about Kennedy's assassination by a woman who he very well may have known, because she was in Cuba at the Hotel Havana. She was Castro's girlfriend, and at the time that he would have been there. And he hung around the hotel lobbies, met Castro, you know, and was hanging out in the scene in Havana just before the Bay of Pigs, when she was absolutely there, and she was kind of the queen of the scene because she was Castro's lover. Running.
Right. So this was right before Karen was arrested then, was it?
Yeah, in 61. So, you know, there's a woman called Marita Lorenz, and you probably haven't heard of her, but she's written a book, and it's a very interesting book called Dear Fidel. And it's her memoir of how she met Fidel in 1958, I think, or 59. So just sort of when was the revolution, right? 59. And I think, right? And she, you know, and how she sailed into Havana Harbor. She was a 19-year-old beauty. And her father was had a Norwegian, ocean liner, that, you know, tourist kind of. Anyway, they sailed into Havana Harbor, and Fidel Castro climbed on board. He came out in a dinghy with some of his rifle-wielding, you know, combat gear-wearing men. And they climbed into the ship, and they talked to the captain. And then they kind of, and Castro seduced the daughter, and Marita, who became his lover, and she kind of took over the running of the hotel. She was a very bright, confident young woman, and she was Castro's lover, mistress. So just at the time of the Bay of Pigs, you know, and he's got a famous poem. Leonard has a poem. He wrote it on the wall of a bistro bathroom in Montreal, and it's in the biography. It goes, Marita, please find me. I am almost 30. Well, Marita is not a name. I've never met anyone in Montreal called Marita. It's not a French-Canadian thing. It's just not something that you ever hear. Marita. And, you know, so, okay, keeping in mind that he may very well have known her. He did write a poem using her name, that name, in 1964. And then a week before he phoned me, Marita Lorenz had gone public with her revelations about the Kennedy assassination and the CIA hit squad that she said was driving, she was part of, and they were driving to Dallas, and they were going to get Kennedy. They were going to shoot Kennedy. She said that it was Frank Sturgis and E. Howard Hunt in the car with her, and, you know, the Watergate burglars later on, and they're suspects, and they're part of the whole Kennedy, you know, assassination theory. You know, one theory is that they were part of it, and they were on the grassy knoll, or they were the tramps or something. You know, they fit into the picture. And then she didn't go all the way to Dallas. She stayed in a motel. She got her period. She didn't feel good, so she didn't go. And in 1977, she gave an interview in the New York Post, and it appeared, and it was just a week before he phoned me. I'm not saying there's anything to it, but could he have been in a mood? First come the revelations about Dr. Cameron and the experimentation in Montreal. It becomes an international news story. And then in early November comes Marita Lorenz, someone he knows, I think, giving an interview about who really killed Kennedy in the New York Post. You know, and did he get in the spirit of, I'm going to contact people who might have been part of this, and maybe this girl, because he knew my name, because he'd read my poem, right? Anne McLean. Plus, the poetry scene had a lot of, I can't go, my editor is in Montreal, poetry scene, knew all about MK Ultra. He used to tell me about it. I didn't get it, you know, but he knew who my father was. My father had fallen out with the Air Force people and the intelligence community by his rebellion. That's why they nearly killed him in 1963. You know, my father was you know, as I say, my parents were under attack. I really think it's true. And so, you know, I think I was known, you know, in a certain circles without having any idea that anyone could know me.
Right.
Then I start publishing little poems. Then I get on Leonard Cohen's radar.
Yeah.
And then I get a phone call, and he knows I'm one of the MK Ultra kids. And he knows that there's a whole bunch of us. And he decides he's going to, you know, call me up, find out what I know. So he, you know, I don't know anything is the answer. And sometime in our into our relationship, he asked me if I remembered being in flotation tanks as a kid. And I couldn't understand what he could possibly be talking about. But yes, it's very likely. I mean, if I was in the experiment that I believe I was in, that I had to have been in, and if I was in the LSD, yeah, I was in flotation tanks.
Right.
You know, along with the other kids.
And because this was the same time he told you about his own experiences in the flotation tanks.
Yeah, he said he loved being in them, yeah.
But at that time you didn't connect that to the McGill experiment.
It wasn't connectable. It was just a kind of one of those, like so many things, until I found out about MKUltra, and I spent those millions of hours reading and everything and absorbing all the detail, right?
Mm-hmm.
So many odd things about my life just didn't connect. And that would have been one of them. There were many things, but Leonard definitely dropped many of those kinds of things into my life that didn't, you know, that just seemed, I just thought that life was absurd, you know, and absurd things happened all the time. And coincidences were just, you know, just that's the fabric of reality, is everything happens coincidentally, miraculously, absurdly, you know, and that's just how it is. But I might have something to do with being given LSD as a child, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, it's literally true in my life that, you know. But then on the other hand, once you work it down to causes,
yeah.
You do that by going back. I'm sure you've done it, and then you begin to see, well, it's just cause and effect.
And a lot of human, a lot more human elements than divine. So not that there's necessarily a difference, but if you know what I mean, it's easy to sort of paint it with one big brush stroke because it's all synchronicity. But actually, if there's human agencies and plans and contrivances and manipulations going on, then that's something very different.
And you'll only understand those later in life and in retrospect. They won't, because you couldn't, there's no way you can put them together if you don't know the original cause, you know. You don't know that there's a massive crime against humanity, you know, has happened in your city. There's a vast effort to cover it up. There are many people involved. There's a lot of money involved in this. You know, there are careers, families, you know. But who would think of that when you're 25 years old? Unless you were really born into the middle of it and people talked, which I don't think they did, you know. All in a needs on a need to know basis, right? These things, that's how they work, right?
Right.
So, but you've had that experience, you know?
I have, to not to the same extent that you have, by any means. But did it occur to you that Cohen might have been feeling you out in terms of what you remembered for a different reason? Besides, I mean, you suggested quite a benevolent reading that he was maybe thinking about being a whistleblower.
Oh, I think he's toyed with that idea, but I'm not sure, you know, that's just giving him, you know,
the benefit again, because the alternate interpretation is that he was assigned to you.
Yeah, I think I'm more inclined to think he was assigned to my generation.
Well, that's in a very wide sense, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I could even back that up with there's a film that shows him, well, there's that film you just watched. Do you remember how he says, or the narrator, who's, I think, Donald Britton?
Yeah.
I mean, well, anyway, I'm sure he was British intelligence, excuse me, but that's who I think the NFB were. But in any case, he's narrating, he says, and Leonard Cohen is 31 years old and lives in downtown Montreal in a hotel, you know, and he's very interested in young people. And then they have a sequence where they show him talking to these bespectacled McGill students, you know, geeks. But nevertheless, he's showing his interest in young people. Well, I think he's been interested in young people for a long time. But there's a film that was made 1966, 67. It's about a Cameron patient. There's no other way to interpret it, you know. In Montreal, it was made by, can't remember the guy's name, but it'll come to me, but he made Robin Spry, I believe, directed it, and another Brit, but anyway, in on the whole scene of this art scene that involved Cohen and some friends. And in any case, it's called The Ernie Game, and it was a kind of a Canadian success, you know, fiction film. It shows a guy, a mental patient, coming out of a mental hospital, and he's very disoriented, and he meets a bunch of people hanging around the scene, including Judy Gault, who was a girlfriend of Cohen at one point, I think, and she's an actress in it, and Leonard Cohen is in it, and he's in the scene where students are, they look like students from McGill. They're all they're at a party. It's a pot party. It's the mid-60s. They're all stoned out of their minds. And he's in the middle of the room and he's doing his Spanish guitar fingering and he sings the Stranger song. And he mesmerizes. They're all mesmerized. In fact, they're all in a stoned, you know, they're immobilized. They're, you know, they're zombies listening to him doing his fingering and singing the song in a hypnotic voice. And, you know, he's put in that film for a reason. He's obviously the Pied Piper, you know, of the generation. You know, he's 10 years older than most of them. And he's going to become their leader. And I think very likely he was assigned. Well, I'm sure he introduced me to people when I knew him. We'd take a walk and we'd meet somebody on the street who was clearly a total mental patient. And it would happen over and over again. And he'd introduce me and say, you should get to know Julie, you know, you should get to know. And I would go, but why? This guy is he's a total wipeout. Like, what is, I just couldn't, why, what do I have in common with this guy, you know? And, oh, you have to, you know, it's like he was always trying to trigger me, it seems, in retrospect. He'd introduce me to people who were so, you know, drugged out and just, they were wrecks because that's what happened to so many.
Right.
You know, I never could see that point. I felt superior, you know, it wasn't about, it's just, I couldn't see what's going on here. You know, why does he know all these people by name?
Wow.
Homeless, you know, Harry Two Hats, the homeless poet, you know, Philip Tetreault, definitely an MK Ultra. A film, an FB film has even been made about him. You know, when you sort of go and look, you see there's a whole, they've been documenting all this. The NFB's been documenting it. I could list some films, you know, and you could go look at them. Not just the one about Cohen, but there've been, they do about the people that were in the program. Ryan Larkin. There's some, you might not know these people, but they were well-known Canadian animators, you know, considered geniuses and so on. All MK Ultra. Ryan Larkin, Arthur Lipsett, you know, this generation of art, the art scene, the film scene and so on, so many of them were products. And they continued to be, they were in a way promoted because their work was so strange and bizarre. Two of them were nominated for Oscars, you know, Arthur Lipsett and Ryan Larkin in the 60s, both nominated for Oscars. So it led all the way to Hollywood, you know. People wanted to get on that train. Fame, you know, drugs, fame, fortune. How did he do it? How did Leonard do it, you know? And it was definitely, that was the scene. But there were the casualties, you know, the walking dead. And, you know, he was in some way the you know, the, like I say, the Pied Piper, the godfather of it. And these are real, that's a social phenomenon. I mean, that was my world. At the same time, it was marginalized in Canada. It was, in some ways, I think, intentionally kept quiet. Toronto never, of course, wanted to know anything that was going on in Montreal, you know, so there was no David Cronenberg made films. You know who he is? He's a Canadian.
Totally, yeah. He made that one of his very early films was about experimentation. What was that one called?
Yeah,
Crimes.
and he put Stephen Lack being an actor from Montreal who became a painter, who's kind of well known in New York now. He's had a pretty good career, and fairly well known in the States as a anyway. An actor, he started out as an actor and was in a Cronenberg film called Scanners, and it was about psychic children and an experiment.
Right, Crimes of the Future was the one I
Oh, I
was trying
haven't
to
seen it.
remember.
Yeah.
Well, we've opened the book, and I don't want to close it yet, or at least, just temporarily. I would like to pick up where we left off, if you're willing, and do another session, maybe another couple of hours, and get into more of the nuance of all of this material.
Oh, sure. It's irresistible. You're very good at your, I didn't realize you were such a gentle, therapeutic kind of interviewer.
That was part two of my conversation with Anne Diamond. Parts three and four will be online at horticulture.com/limitless on Wednesday, the 16th of September 2015. If you want to look more into some of the subject matter that Anne and I are discussing, you can find links in the show notes, and you can also find Anne Diamond's self-published works linked also there at the website. Thanks for listening. This is Jason Horsley, liminally speaking. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so at the website by donating via PayPal or by becoming a patron at patreon.com/liminalist. I was a construct of your contusion. Desperate to believe what you hoped to be, but it only led to confusion. I will disappoint you. And you, expectations, they sometimes burn you, and they spurn the moves you make. So walk away from your conclusions, and your illusions soon will fade. Take me as I am. I'm doing what I can. And just like you, I am broken. I'm trying to make a stand in my house of sand. And my eyes once shut, now are open. I.